You're listening to First Point Japan's Spotlight Series, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins. And now, here's your host, James Santagata.
As you know, one of the main themes of this portal is discussing a lot of the informational asymmetries with business within Japan and helping corporations and business people both identify and mitigate, if not eliminate, operational and legal risks, as well as also trying to maximize the upside opportunities. And we've done a lot of I think very important things in the past, including some law firms, the fashion industry. And today we're very pleased to have as our guest Bill Leza, who is with Leza Partners, which is a patent translation and interpretation firm. And with that, I'd like to welcome Bill to the program. How are you doing, Bill?
Hello. Good afternoon.
Great. Well, thank you very much for thanks for joining us. Actually, we were talking before the interview, I'd come across your firm and what you did on the internet. Actually, just Googling some other issues, and I thought it was very interesting because I can't really think of anything perhaps that has maybe greater informational asymmetries than what you're actually doing. Could you perhaps give a brief thumbnail sketch of what your firm does and maybe what the line of business is?
Well, we're basically best characterized as being a patent translation and litigation, and that is also patent litigation interpreting boutique.
Okay.
We're small, mm-hmm. And I think we're better for being small, and the translation business happens to be one where getting large, growing, brings mm-hmm. with it a whole host of problems. We've been in the business for over 30 years doing basically patent translation.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, within that, we talked about this a bit before also, but within the patent litigation, I understand one thing that you're very big in, of course, is depositions. Is that correct then?
That is right. And for people listening who are not familiar with depositions, that's part of the civil procedure in the U.S. where essentially testimony is taken by mm-hmm. Each side of the other side's deponents before the actual trial.
Interesting. Now, within this, too, I can imagine there's probably a very select group or very few, as you might say, on the supply side. Is this a very, very niche area, I would guess, then?
It is an extreme niche. I can name about two or three other people who do what I do at native English level, mm-hmm. have a background of a lot of experience doing depositions, and actually want to do deposition interpreting. It's a very stressful thing. Then there are many, many other interpreters who do one deposition and perhaps never have an opportunity to do another deposition or don't want to do another deposition. But yes, mm-hmm. it is a very narrow niche supplied by a very small group of interpreters.
I see. And I could imagine, too, I could probably see maybe three issues or needed skills here. One is, of course, the subject or domain expertise, the linguistic mastery, and, of course, I could imagine it'd be very stressful for most people in that kind of high-pressure, high-stakes arena dealing with such subject matter facing that opposing counsel as well. So is that maybe characterize the process there?
Yes, and I think it's an interpreting process and environment that is perhaps not very well understood. Mm-hmm. Simultaneous interpreting at conferences has a very high profile.
Okay.
People sitting in the booth doing that, running on and on, doing amazing work, very well in many cases, mm-hmm. is one thing. What we do is consecutive interpreting that must be much more accurate. And another mm-hmm. element that makes it very different and very stressful
yes.
is that there is a Czech interpreter on the other side who will raise his or her hand if you do something incorrectly.
Interesting.
That makes it very stressful.
I see. Now, I can imagine, too, from the firm's point of view with all of these companies, again, I don't expect you to name any companies that you're working with, but I'm just throwing names out, whether it's Apple or Intel or Japanese domestics, with all of the innovation we see and a lot of these IP fights and patent things going on, it seems like the company may put millions of dollars into the development of that IP, and then when it comes down to the defense of that patent or other litigation, I mean, it really comes down, I guess, to also how good the interpreter is within that deposition. Is that correct?
Well, it's certainly a good interpreter can certainly save a deposition from being sunken. The interpreter, it would be, you know, too self-serving for me to say that the interpreter is the key element in winning a case or in making
sure
points in a deposition. But certainly a bad interpreter is going to risk wasting lots and lots of very expensive attorney time and messing up things in a logistics sense, because there are a set of conditions in Japan for doing depositions that are unique to Japan. They can't be done in law firms. They must be done in the U.S. embassy in Tokyo or the U.S. consulate in Osaka. So it's very touchy in terms of arrangements.
Okay, interesting. Now, I guess maybe continuing on that, how do we, especially if, you know, we have these asymmetries, how do we identify, I guess, a so-called bad interpreter, a good one? Is there certifications, or does that even matter? How do we go about finding that?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned certifications. Whereas there are certifications for translation, one that I have is I am a certified Japanese to English translator, certified by the American Translators Association. The interpreting side doesn't really have a similar or corresponding certification. For court certifications, there are certifications in certain states, California, one of them, that will certify two American, you know, Native American languages and Spanish, but Japanese is left out. It just falls through a crack. In Japan, there is no court certification. So if you go to, for example, the Tokyo District Court and watch a case that is being interpreted, you will see it being interpreted by someone who has no qualifications. There are movements now on to change that situation in Japan. I'm not really sure if we're very close in the United States. So how do you identify a good interpreter? Hire one, and you will find out whether the interpreter is good. Or use someone who is recommended to you by someone who has used them previously. It's very difficult for someone who isn't an interpreter to figure out whether someone can be a good interpreter for you.
Yes, right. Now, also, we see this. You know, I'm in the high tech recruiting side, and we have these, perhaps not as great as your informational symmetries, but we see a lot of moves, and it, you know, I can understand why in the current environment to move things offshore, sometimes to India or China. And I know in the recruiting side, we've also seen issues with IP kind of disappearing or diffusing out to competitors. Have you seen? Is there a move to for maybe the patent translations, obviously interpreting is different, but on the translation side, is there pressure, or have you seen movements where they've tried to move it offshore, or any thoughts on that?
Well, limiting my comments to translation, because interpreting, as you imagine, is not going to be outsourced to India or China. Patent translation, at least patent translation as it is done in the United States, which is one of the two major varieties of translation, which is non-filing translation. We're not where jobs are translated not for Japanese clients who are filing patents overseas, but for someone in the United States, a law firm or a manufacturer who wants to know what a patent says. That work has started to go to India and to China. It is the fact that it's going there is unknown to some clients, perhaps many clients in the United States. But the rise of Indian and Chinese, Japanese to English translators and translation providers has worked to lower the rates in the United States.
I see.
What we do is not really affected by that, because we're dealing almost exclusively with major law firms and not mass translation or Japanese clients who, by and large, wouldn't think of sending their translation work to someone who would pass it off to India or China.
I see. So
it hasn't affected my business. Yeah, it hasn't affected my business, but I think it has worked to lower the rates significantly in the United States.
Okay. Also, I came across something else you had. I think it was on your website, which I thought was quite interesting. You know, many times for people that aren't either bilingual or proficient in certain languages, we may have a tendency to think that a person who speaks both languages can do any subject matter. But I remember seeing a presentation you had where you clearly had made this statement. I'm going to paraphrase you, but that translation is always about something. And I guess there's always some domain expertise where, just like if we were in English, I may be a native speaker, but I probably can't speak very competently about pharmaceuticals, for instance. Is this something that most clients are aware of, or is that even an issue?
Well, when you talk about direct clients, the actual, for example, a manufacturer who's manufacturing a high-tech product,
yes.
If that client meets a translator or an interpreter, and that translator or interpreter is not up to speed on their technology, the translator or interpreter will be found out immediately.
I see.
Because there is a system of working through agencies, that deficiency is not usually discovered, but it is very important to know the content. Many translators say they're general translators. Now, I can understand that they may say that because they're afraid of not getting enough work if they say, if they list a specific field, but
yes.
There's no such thing as general translation. You have to be
anything
that's about that is that general is not very valuable. The more specific, more field specific it is, the more valuable it is to a client. And yes, it's very important. Language ability in both languages, the source and the target, and a firm grasp of the technology in between.
I see. Interesting.
Those are the three pillars I usually talk about as being important in holding up the whole process of translation and interpreting.
I see. Yes, great. Also, kind of going back, actually, in your background, I think you also have a technical degree. Is that correct? Or technical background?
Yeah, in my previous life, I was an electrical engineer.
Okay.
My first job after getting out of the Navy was working for what was then called Western Electric. Before it was dismantled, I was working in microwaves and fiber optics laboratory. Then I was picked up by a measuring instrument company to start their branch in Japan, and that was in the late 70s.
Okay, interesting.
So
great.
I'm from absolutely a former geek. Very firmly grounded in electronics.
Okay, great. And then also within the language part. I'm curious, how did you, pick up Japanese, or had you had experience with any other, study of foreign languages as well?
Well, when I went into the Navy many years ago, 1966, I opted for language training in Russian. Well, if you remember, the Cold War was going full force. Became a Russian specialist, and that was the opportunity to come to Japan. After I got here, I spent many hours studiously avoiding Japanese people who spoke English and concentrating on my own study. I'm really an autodidact. I mean, I've done it all myself, but that is rather slighting to the Japanese around me, because you really can't learn spoken Japanese without having the stimulus of Japanese around you. And I've spent a lot of hours getting lots and lots of stimulus in that area. I'm self-taught. There are many translators and interpreters who are not self-taught, and I'm not a case against learning Japanese in a formal educational environment, but I am a case against against saying that a formal Japanese education is essential. I'm the other side of the coin. It can be done without it.
Okay, interesting. Actually, that brings up another question that just kind of popped in my brain here is, in dealing with, and again, I've never been in the legal environment there in Japanese, but in dealing on the business side, oftentimes there's a lot of vagaries with the way I find it, and that's not good or bad, but that I see the way Japanese may present, maybe not being as explicit or direct. Is that also come through? Is there a lot of nuances in these depositions with the Japanese language, or is it much more emphatic in that environment?
Well, it's kind of a funny situation. When you're interpreting in a deposition, Obviously, the deponent has been prepared not to be vague or to be vague,
right.
depending upon
okay.
whether his memory of account of something, how something happened, is vague or not.
Yes.
Sometimes, occasionally, you will run into expressions that are very, 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 very controlled by cultural and business culture.
Yes.
Things in Japan. For example, there is a term in Japanese that the term is sumiwake.
Okay.
That is a term that effectively means live and let live. It means you'll have your space to live in and I'll have my space to live in.
Okay.
But seen from another standpoint, it can be, and that standpoint being the Department of Justice in the United States, it can be interpreted as being price fixing. Dividing up the market. So you have, the interpreter is faced with a dilemma of how to render something like that.
I understand.
When it happens in a professional interpreting
yes.
environment. Interpreters do not have the luxury of being able to write a footnote as translators do about a certain word that is used.
That's very interesting. You said, I guess, and this is probably doesn't do with the deposition, but I was thinking if we think of corporate structure, I'm going to use the U.S. versus Japan. You know, there could be a C corp or an S corp or an LLC, and that may not directly map to what a Kabushiki Gaisha is. I mean, theoretically, they have liability protection, but the actual reporting or filing requirements and such can be completely different. You know what I'm saying? So there's this. It doesn't always map out, I guess, directly. The concepts between the languages then.
Yeah, and this, with the particular example you give about the forms of corporation, which are, you know, the systems are different, the wise translator and interpreter will mark the expressions to indicate the types of companies, to indicate that what they're specifically talking about is a U.S. corporation or a Japanese corporation.
See.
This is why many Japanese company names, when they appear on patents, have KK after them.
To
make it very, very clear that it is the Japanese company that holds the patent and not their American subsidiary, for example.
I see. That's very fascinating. I see. So then, of course, the accuracy is extremely critical in any one of these depositions, but especially in this multilingual environment, or maybe it's multi-jurisdictional as well, to really note the all of these the granular details, I guess.
Oh yes.
Very critical.
And that's one of the reasons why there are checking interpreters in the room along with the lead interpreter.
I see.
So that things don't go wrong. An attorney can waste a lot of time asking questions based on a response that was not correct or not correctly interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
And can go down a road that will lead nowhere unless it is corrected at the time when it actually happens. And that's the job of the checking interpreter. And I'm very often the checking interpreter.
I see. Interesting. Now, in terms of trends, I mean, obviously we've had, a restructuring of the economies and a little bit bumpy road. But I've noticed, at least maybe I'm more aware now, but I see a lot of different patent issues coming up. We've seen Apple and Samsung and things happening in Europe, and Google, I think, bought Motorola Mobility for the patent portfolio. Are you seeing? Is there an increase in this activity in Japan recently, or how do we see any kind of trends happening?
Well, the type of work that I'm involved in can probably be classified into two categories, in the interpreting work, that is. One is major manufacturers litigating against each other. And I haven't incidentally been involved with any of, for example, Apple and Samsung, because I wouldn't have any input into that, because there are no Japanese deponents to be giving testimony. So a lot of the really high-profile profile cases that you hear about are not involving Japanese these days. The Japanese firms, on the other hand, are starting to use effectively the ITC, International Trade Commission, in the United States to get injunctions against people who are infringing their patents in the U.S. This is something that did not happen, let's say, 20 years ago. It was unheard of for Japanese firms to actively go out and use their intellectual property as an asset and assert their patents against other firms. 4 or 5 weeks ago, I was involved with an ITC case between two Japanese firms fighting each other in the United States.
I see.
And that is a fairly rare event, even these days. But I don't generally see the large firms that have these very, very high profile cases. Then the other type of litigation that I'm sometimes involved in is brought against Japanese firms by what are called NPEs, non-practicing entities.
Okay.
These are essentially what are normally called patent trolls.
Okay.
They are firms sometimes no more than two or three attorneys, sometimes even one attorney, who has essentially purchased a package of patents, a patent portfolio from other companies. That company, the troll company, doesn't do any manufacturing, but by the U.S. law, they are allowed to assert the patents against other companies. And that is a great thorn in the side of Japanese firms. The Japanese companies here are often preyed upon by what we call patent trolls, or when we're being nicer, we call them non-practicing entities because they're not practicing the patent.
Okay. Actually, it's funny you said, I've only heard the word patent troll. I didn't know there was a non-pejorative word.
Yes, there's a politically correct term for it, NPE.
I see. Okay. Interesting. Now, also, is that something that is, I guess the other question is, recently in the news, we've seen quite a bit of things with Japanese, again, trying to maybe have a new push to go overseas with the high end. They're making acquisitions. I've seen them working on globalizing HR. Do you think that if they begin to push forward, there may be more of this give and take with litigation both ways, either with Japanese domestics fighting each other, or is this any ideas on how the trends may play out here?
Well, with regard to the locations where Japanese may be moving overseas to avoid the problem with the exchange rate, if you're talking about China, it's a non-starter for them at doing any assertion of their intellectual property rights in China. It's not a place to litigate. The U.S. is still the venue of choice to litigate, even against Chinese companies, for example. I don't really get involved in, you know, the movement of Japanese companies overseas. I used to many years ago when we did a lot of instruction manual translations, because, for example, Honda would open a plant and immediately have to have lots and lots of documentation translated into English because they're opening a plant in the U.S.
I see.
But I'm not much involved in or affected by any recent movement over offshore because of exchange rate problems. That's something that doesn't really affect me, or I really don't even see it. It's invisible to my business.
I see. Okay, very interesting. Great. Okay, I think that's pretty much what we had. That was a very, great discussion here. Bill, is there anything else you would like to add that maybe we haven't covered or you think could be important to either business people or law firms or such that have getting involved in some of these depositions or interpretation or translation work?
Well, if I have anything to give to someone who's looking for someone who is a professional and can provide professional level service, it probably would be, and this is because it's so difficult to actually evaluate people, it would be to listen to someone who uses that person or that company. Essentially, ask the man who uses one, if not owns one. Because recommendations have traditionally been very important in Japan, and in this area, I think they're important even for people operating in the United States and looking for language services having to do with Japanese.
Makes a lot of sense. Great. Okay, well, we're with Bill Leza of Leza Partners. Bill, we want to thank you very much for your time today and for sharing your insights into patent translation and interpretation services.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed speaking with you, and hope I've imparted something that might be somewhat useful to somebody somewhere.
Great. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for listening. This program has been a presentation of First Point Japan, where we interview the people and analyze the things that matter for you to establish, build out, and accelerate your Japan business. Only at firstpointjapan.com, where Japanese business begins.